Side 3. "So, you're Peter Franks," she said, and the voice was low and attractive, but with a touch of condescension.
"Yes," he said, "and I've been wondering what T stands for."
She thought for a moment. "I guess you can find out at the desk," she said. "It stands for Tiffany."
She walked over to the gramophone and stopped the record in the middle of Je n'en connais pas la fin. She turned round. "But it's not in the public domain," she added coldly. Bond shrugged his shoulders and moved over to the windowsill and leant easily against it with his ankles crossed. His nonchalance seemed to irritate her. She sat down in front of the writing desk. "Now then," she said, and her voice had an edge to it, "let's get down to business. In the first place, why do you take this job?"
"Somebody died."
"Oh." She looked at him sharply. "They told me your line was stealing." She paused. "Hot blood or cold blood?"
"Hot blood. A fight."
"So you want to get out?"
"That's about it.
And the money." She changed the subject. "Got a wooden leg? False teeth?"
"No, everything's real."
She frowned. "I'm always telling them to find me a man with a wooden leg. Well, have you got any hobbies or anything? Any ideas where you're going to carry the stones?"
"No," said Bond. "I play cards and golf. But I thought the handles of trunks and suitcases were good places for this sort of stuff."
"So do the customs men," she said dryly. She sat silent for a moment, reflecting. Then she pulled a piece of paper and a pencil towards her. "What sort of golf balls do you use?" she asked, unsmilingly.
"They're called Dunlop 65s. He was equally serious. "And maybe you've got something there."
She made no comment, but wrote the name down. She looked up. "Got a passport?"
"Well, I have," admitted Bond, "but it's in my real name."
"Oh," she was suspicious again. "And what might that be?"
"James Bond."
She snorted.
"Why not choose Joe Doe?"
She shrugged her shoulders.
"Who cares, anyway? Can you get an American visa in 2 days, and a vaccination certificate?"
"Don't see why not," said Bond. "Q Branch would fix all that.
There's nothing against me in America, or its criminal records here, for the matter of that. Under Bond, that is."
"Okay," she said. "Now listen, immigration will need this. You're going over to the States to stay with a man called Tree, Michael Tree. You'll be staying at the Astor in New York. He's an American friend of yours. You met him in the war." She unbent minutely. "Just for the record, this man really exists. He'll back up your story, but he's not generally known as Michael. He's known as Shady Tree to his friends, if any," she added sourly.
Bond smiled.
"He's not as fun as he sounds," said the girl shortly. She opened a drawer in the desk and took out a packet of £5 notes with a rubber band round it. She riffled them through and detached about half their number and put these back in the drawer. She rolled up the rest, snapped the rubber band round them, and tossed the packet across the room to Bond. Bond leant forward and caught it near the floor.
"There's about £500 in there," she said. "Book yourself in at the Ritz and give that address to immigration. Get a good used suitcase and put in what you would take on a golfing holiday. Get your golf clubs. Keep out of sight. BOAC Monarch to New York, Thursday evening. Get a single ticket first thing tomorrow morning. The embassy won't give you a visa without seeing your ticket. Car will pick you up at the Ritz at 6:30 Thursday evening. Driver will give you the golf balls. Put them in your bag, and," she looked him straight in the eye, "don't think you can go into business for yourself with this stuff. The driver will stay alongside you until your luggage has gone out to the plane, and I'll be at London Airport, so no funny business, okay?"
Bond shrugged his shoulders. "What would I do with this kind of merchandise?" he said carelessly. "Too big for me.
And what happens at the other end?"
"Another driver will be waiting outside the customs. He'll tell you what to do next. Now," her voice was urgent, "if anything happens at the customs, either end, you know nothing, see? You just don't know how the balls got into your bag. Whatever they ask, you just go on saying, 'By me.' Act dumb. I should be watching. And maybe others, too. That I wouldn't know. If they lock you up in America, ask for the British consul and go on asking. You won't get any help from us, but that's what you're being paid for. Okay?"
"Fair enough," said Bond. "The only person I could get into trouble would be you."
He looked appraisingly at her.
"And I wouldn't like that to happen."
"Shucks," she said scornfully. "You've got nothing on me. Don't worry about me, my friend. I can look after myself." She got up and came and stood in front of him.
"And don't little girl me," she said sharply. "We're on a job, and I can take care of myself. You'd be surprised."
Bond stood up and away from the windowsill. He smiled down and into the flashing grey eyes that were now dark with impatience. I can do anything better than you can. Don't worry, I'll be a credit to you. But just relax and stop being so businesslike for a minute. I'd like to see you again. Could we meet in New York if everything goes all right? Bond felt treacherous as he said the words. He liked this girl. He wanted to make friends with her, but it would be a question of using friendship to get further up the pipeline. She looked thoughtfully at him for a moment, and her eyes gradually lost their darkness. Her sharply compressed lips relaxed and parted a little. There was a hint of a stammer in her voice as she answered him. She brusquely turned away from him. Hell, she said, but the word sounded artificial. I've got nothing on Friday night. Guess we might have dinner at 21 Club on 52nd. All the cab drivers know it. 8 o'clock, if the job goes off okay. Suit you? She turned back towards him and looked at his mouth and not his eyes. Fine, said Bond. He thought it was time to get out before he made a mistake. No, he said efficiently. Is there anything else? No, she said, and then sharply, as if she had just remembered something. What's the time? Bond looked at his watch. 10 to 6. I've got to get busy, she said. With a movement of dismissal, she walked towards the door. Bond followed her. With her hand on the key, she turned. She looked at him, and there was confidence and almost warmth in her eyes. You'll be all right, she said. Just keep away from me in the plane. Don't panic if anything goes wrong. If you work out okay, the patronizing note came back in her voice, I'll try and get you some more of the same sort of jobs. Thanks, said Bond. I'd appreciate that. I'd enjoy working with you. With a slight shrug of the shoulders, she opened the door, and Bond walked out into the corridor. He turned. See you at this 21 place of yours, he said. He wanted to say more, to find an excuse to stay with her, with this lonely girl who played the gramophone and gazed at herself in the mirror. But now her expression was remote. He might have been a complete stranger. Sure, she said indifferently. She looked at him once more, and then she closed the door, slowly but firmly, on his face. As Bond walked away down the long corridor to the lift, the girl stood just inside the door and listened until his footsteps had vanished. Then, with brooding eyes, she walked slowly over to the gramophone and switched it on. She picked up the Fair record and searched for the groove she wanted. She put the record on the machine and found the place with the needle. The tune was Je n'en connais pas la fin. She stood listening to it and wondering about the man who had suddenly, out of the blue, found his way into her life. God, she thought to herself with sudden, angry despair, another damn crook. Couldn't she ever get away from them? But when the record stopped, her face was happy, and she hummed the tune as she powdered her nose and got ready to go out. Out on the street, she paused and looked at her watch. 6:10, 5 minutes to go. She walked across Trafalgar Square to Charing Cross Station, arranging in her mind what she was going to say. Then she went into the station and into one of the call boxes she always used. It was just 6:15 when she dialed the Welbeck number. After the usual 2 rings, she heard the click of the automatic recorder taking the call. For 20 seconds she heard nothing but the sharp hiss of a needle on wax. Then the neutral voice that was her unknown master said the one word, "Speak." And then there was silence again, except for the hiss of the recorder. She had long got over being flustered by the abrupt, disembodied command. She spoke rapidly but distinctly into the black mouthpiece. Case to ABC. I repeat, case to ABC. She paused. Carrier is satisfactory. Says real name is James Bond and will use that name on passport. Plays golf and will carry golf clubs. Suggest golf balls. Uses Dunlop 65s. All other arrangements stand. We'll call for confirmation at 19:15 and 20:15. That's all. She listened for a moment to the hiss of the recorder. Then she put down the receiver and walked back to her hotel. She called room service for a large, dry martini, and when it came, she sat and smoked and played the gramophone and waited for 7:15.
Then, or perhaps not until she called back again at 8:15, the neutral, muffled voice would come back at her over the telephone wire. ABC to Case. I repeat, ABC to Case. And then would follow her instructions. And somewhere, in some rented room in London, the hiss of the recorder would stop as she put back the receiver. And then, perhaps, an unknown door would close, and footsteps would softly sound on some stairs, and out into an unknown street, and away. Chapter 6. In Transit. It was 6 o'clock on Thursday evening, and Bond was packing his suitcase in his bedroom at the Ritz. It was a battered, but once expensive, pigskin revelation, and its contents were appropriate to his cover. Evening clothes, his lightweight black-and-white dogtooth suit for the country and for golf, Saxon golf shoes, a companion to the dark blue tropical worsted suit he was wearing, and some white silk and dark blue Sea Island cotton shirts with collars attached and short sleeves, socks and ties, some nylon underclothes, and two pairs of the long silk pyjama coats he wore in place of two-piece pyjamas. None of these things bore, or had ever borne, any name tags or initials. Bond completed his task and proceeded to fit his remaining possessions, his shaving and washing gear, Tommy armor on how to play your best golf all the time, and his tickets and passport into a small attaché case, also of battered pigskin. This had been prepared for him by Q Branch, and there was a narrow compartment under the leather at the back, which contained a silencer for his gun and 30 rounds of .25 ammunition. The telephone rang. He assumed it was the car, early at the rendezvous, but it was the hall porter saying that there was a representative of Universal Export with a letter to be delivered personally to Bond. "Send him up," said Bond, wondering. A few minutes later, he opened the door to a man in plain clothes whom he recognized as one of the messengers in the pool at headquarters. "Good evening, sir," said the man. He took a large plain envelope out of his breast pocket and handed it to Bond. "I'm to wait and take this back when you've read it, sir." Bond opened the white envelope and broke the seal of the blue envelope which it contained. There was a page of blue typewritten foolscap paper with no address and no signature. Bond recognized the extra-large type used in M's, personal communications. Bond waved the messenger to a chair and sat down at the writing desk opposite the window. "Washington," said the memorandum, "reports that Rufus B. Say is an alias for Jack Spang, a suspected gangster who was mentioned in the Kofova report, but who has no criminal record. He is, however, twin brother to Serafimo Spang, and joint controller of the Spangled Mob, which operates widely in the United States. The brothers Spang bought control of the House of Diamonds 5 years ago, as an investment, and nothing unfavorable is known about this business, which appears to be perfectly legitimate. The brothers also own a wire service, which serves off-the-course bookmakers in Nevada and California, and is therefore illegal. The name of this is the Sure Fire Wire Service. They also own the Tiara Hotel in Las Vegas, and this is the headquarters of Serafimo Spang, and also, to benefit from the Nevada tax laws, the company offices of the House of Diamonds. Washington adds that the Spangled Mob is interested in other illegal activities, such as narcotics and organized prostitution, and these lines are handled from New York by Michael Shady Tree, who has 5 previous convictions for various offenses. The gang has branch headquarters in Miami, Detroit, and Chicago. Washington describes the Spangled Mob as one of the most powerful gangs in the United States, with excellent protection in state and federal governments, and with the police. With the Cleveland outfit and the Detroit Purple Gang, the Spangled Mob has top classification. Our interest in these matters has not been divulged to Washington, but in the event that your inquiries lead you into dangerous contact with this gang, you will report at once and be withdrawn from the case, which will then be handed over to the FBI. This is an order. The return of this document in a sealed envelope will acknowledge your receipt of this order." There was no signature. Bond ran his eyes down the page again, folded it, and placed it in one of the Ritz envelopes. He got up and handed the envelope to the messenger. "Thanks very much," he said. "Can you find your own way downstairs?" "Yes, thank you, sir," said the messenger. He went to the door and opened it. Good night, sir.
Good night.
The door closed quietly. Bond walked across the room to the window and looked out over Green Park. For a moment he had a clear vision of the spare, elderly figure sitting back in his chair in the quiet office. Give the case to the FBI. Bond knew M meant it, but he also knew how bitter it would be for M to have to ask Edgar Hoover to take a case over from the Secret Service and pick Britain's chestnuts out of the fire. The operative words in the memorandum were dangerous contact. What constituted dangerous contact would be a matter for Bond to decide. Compared with some of the opposition he had been up against, these hoodlums surely wouldn't count for much. Or would they? Bond suddenly remembered the chunky, quartz-like face of Rufus B. Say. Well, at any rate, it could do no harm to try and get a look at this brother with the exotic name, Serafimo. The name of a nightclub waiter or an ice cream vendor, but these people were like that, cheap and theatrical. Bond shrugged his shoulders. He glanced at his watch. 6:25. He looked round the room. Everything was ready. On an impulse, he put his right hand under his coat and drew the .25 Beretta automatic with a skeleton grip out of the chamois leather holster that hung just below his left armpit. It was the new gun M had given him as a memento after his last assignment, with a note in M's green ink that had said, "You may need this." Bond walked over to the bed, snapped out the magazine and pumped the single round in the chamber out onto the bedspread. He worked the action several times and sensed the tension on the trigger spring as he squeezed and fired the empty gun. He pulled back the breech and verified that there was no dust round the pin, which he had spent so many hours filing to a point, and he ran his hand down the blue barrel from the tip of which he had personally sawn the blunt foresight. Then he snapped the spare round back into the magazine, and the magazine into the taped butt of the thin gun, pumped the action for a last time, put up the safe, and slipped the gun back under his coat. The telephone rang. "Your car's here, sir." Bond put down the receiver. So, here it was. The off. He walked thoughtfully over to the window and looked out again across the green trees. He felt a slight emptiness in the stomach, a sudden pang at cutting the painter with those green trees that were London in high summer, and a loneliness at the thought of the big building in Regent's Park, the fortress which would now be out of reach except to a call for help, which he knew it would not be in him to make. There was a knock on the door, and when a page came in for his bags, Bond followed him out of the room and along the corridor, and his mind was swept clean of everything except what waited at the mouth of the pipeline that lay open for him outside the swing doors of the Ritz Hotel. It was a black Armstrong Siddeley Sapphire with red trade plates. "You'd like to sit up front," said the uniformed chauffeur. It was not an invitation. Bond's two bags and his golf clubs were put in the back. He settled himself comfortably, and as they turned into Piccadilly, he examined the face of the driver. All he could see was a hard, anonymous profile under a peaked cap. The eyes were concealed behind black sun goggles. The hands that expertly used the wheel and the gears wore leather gloves. "Just relax and enjoy the ride, mister." The accent was Brooklyn. "Don't bother with conversation. Makes me nervous." Bond smiled and said nothing. He did as he was told. 40, he thought, 12 stone, 5'10", expert driver, very familiar with London traffic, no smell of tobacco, expensive shoes, neat dresser. No 5 o'clock shadow. Query shaves twice a day with electric razor. After the roundabout at the end of the Great West Road, the driver pulled into the side. He opened the glove compartment and carefully removed 6 new Dunlop 65s in their black wrapping paper and with the seals intact. Leaving the engine idling in neutral, he got out of the front seat and opened the rear door. Bond looked over his shoulder and watched the man unstrap the ball pocket on his golf bag and, one by one, carefully add the 6 new balls to the miscellaneous old and new ones the pocket already contained. Then, without a word, the man climbed back into the front seat, and the drive continued. At London Airport, Bond unconcernedly went through the luggage and ticket routine, bought himself the Evening Standard, allowing his arm, as he put down his pennies, to brush against an attractive blonde. in a tan travelling suit, who was idly turning the pages of a magazine, and, accompanied by the driver, followed his luggage through to the customs.
"Just your personal effects, sir?"
"Yes. And how much English money have you, sir?" "About £3 and some silver."
"Thank you, sir."
The blue chalk made a scribble on the three bags, and the porter picked up the suitcase and clubs and loaded them on a trolley.
"Follow the yellow light to immigration, sir,"
he said, and wheeled the trolley off towards the loading bay. The driver gave Bond an ironical salute. The smudge of two eyes met his for a moment through the dark glass of the goggles, and the lips narrowed in a thin smile.
"Good night, sir. Pleasant trip."
"Thank you, my man," said Bond cheerfully, and had the satisfaction of seeing the smile vanish as the driver turned and walked quickly away. Bond picked up his attaché case, showed his passport to a pleasant, fresh-faced young man who ticked his name off the passenger list, and walked through into the departure lounge. Just behind him, he heard Tiffany Case's low voice say, "Thank you," to the fresh-faced young man, and a moment later she also came into the lounge and chose a seat between him and the door. Bond smiled to himself. It was where he would have chosen to sit if he had been tailing someone who might have second thoughts. Bond picked up his Evening Standard and casually examined the other passengers over the top of it. The plane would be nearly full. Bond had been too late to get a sleeping berth, and he was relieved to see that among the 40 people in the lounge there was not a face he recognized. Some miscellaneous English, two of the usual nuns, who, Bond reflected, seemed always to be flying the Atlantic in the summer, lured, perhaps, some nondescript Americans, mostly of the business type, two babies in arms to keep the passengers from sleeping, and a handful of indeterminate Europeans. A typical load, decided Bond, while admitting that if two of their number, himself and Tiffany Case, had their secrets, there was no reason why many of these dull people should not also be bound on strange missions. Bond felt that he was being watched, but it was only the blank gaze of two of the passengers he had put down as American businessmen. Their eyes shifted casually away, and one of them, a man with a young face but prematurely white hair, said something to the other, and they both got up, picked up their Stetsons, which, although it was summer, were encased in waterproof covers, and walked over to the bar. Bond heard them order double brandies and water, and the second man, who was pale and fat, took a bottle of pills out of his pocket and swallowed one down with his brandy. Dramamine, guessed Bond, the man would be a bad traveller. The BOAC flight dispatcher was close to Bond. She picked up the telephone, to flight control, Bond supposed, and said, "I have 40 passengers in the final lounge." She waited for the okay and then put the telephone back and picked up the microphone. Final lounge. Cheerful start of flying the Atlantic, reflected Bond. And then they were all walking across the tarmac and up into the big Boeing, and with a burst of oil and methanol smoke, the engines fired one by one. The chief steward announced over the loudspeaker that the next stop would be Shannon, where they would dine, and that the flying time would be 1 hour and 50 minutes, and the great double-decker Stratocruiser rolled slowly out to the east-west runway. The aircraft trembled against its brakes as the captain revved the four engines, one at a time, up to takeoff speed, and through his window Bond watched the wing flaps being tested. Then the great plane turned slowly towards the setting sun. There was a jerk as the brakes were released, and the grass on either side of the runway flattened as, gathering speed, the Monarch hurtled down the 2 miles of stressed concrete and rose into the west, aiming ultimately for another little strip of concrete carpet on the other side of the world. Bond lit a cigarette and was settling himself with his book when the back of the reclining seat on the left of the pair in front of him was lowered sharply towards him. It was one of the two American businessmen, the fat one, lying slumped down with his safety belt still fastened round his stomach. His face was green and sweating. He held a briefcase clutched across his chest, and Bond could read the name on the visiting card inserted in the leather label tag. It said, "Mr. W. Winter," and below, in neat red ink capitals, was written, "My blood group is F." "Poor brute," thought Bond. "He's terrified. He knows the plane is going to crash. He just hopes the men who pull him out of the wreckage will give him the right blood transfusion. To him, this plane is nothing but a giant tube, full of anonymous dead weight, supported in the air by a handful of sparking plugs,
and guided to its destination by a scrap of electricity. He has no faith in it, and no faith in safety statistics. He is suffering the same fears he had as a small child, the fear of noise and the fear of falling. He won't even dare to go to the lavatory for fear he'll put his foot through the floor of the plane when he stands up. A silhouette broke the rays of the evening sun that filled the cabin, and Bond glanced away from the man. It was Tiffany Case. She walked past him to the stairs leading down to the cocktail lounge on the lower deck and disappeared. Bond would have liked to follow her. He shrugged his shoulders and waited for the steward to wheel around the tray of cocktails and the caviar and smoked salmon canapes. He turned again to his book and read a page without understanding a single word. He put the girl out of his mind and started the page again. Bond had read a quarter of the book when he felt his ears begin to block as the plane started its 50-mile descent towards the western coastline of Ireland. Fasten your seatbelts, no smoking. And there was the green and white searchlight of Shannon, and the red and gold of the flare path rushing towards them, and then the brilliant blue of the ground lights between which the stratocruiser trundled towards the unloading bay. Steak and champagne for dinner, and the wonderful goblet of thick coffee laced with Irish whiskey and topped with half an inch of thick cream. A glance at the junk in the airport shops, the Irish horn rosaries, the bog oak Irish harp, and the brass leprechauns, all at $1.50, and the ghastly Irish musical cottage at $4, the furry, unwearable tweeds and the dainty Irish linen doilies and cocktail napkins, and then the Irish rigmarole coming over the loudspeaker, in which only the words BOAC and New York were comprehensible, the translation into English. The last look at Europe, and they were climbing to 15,000 feet, and heading for their next contact with the surface of the world, the radio beacons on the weather ships Jig and Charlie, marking time around their compass points somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic. Bond slept well, and awoke only when they were approaching the southern shores of Nova Scotia. He went forward to the washroom and shaved, and gargled away the taste of a night of pressurized air, and then he went back to his seat between the lines of crumpled, stirring passengers, and had his usual moment of exhilaration as the sun came up over the rim of the world and bathed the cabin in blood. Slowly, with the dawn, the plane came alive. 20,000 feet below, the houses began to show like grains of sugar spilt across a brown carpet. Nothing moved on the earth's surface, except a thin worm of smoke from a train, a straight white feather of a fishing boat's wake across an inlet, and the glint of chromium from a toy motor car caught in the sun. But Bond could almost see the sleeping humps under the bedclothes beginning to stir, and where there was a wisp of smoke rising into the still morning air, he could smell the coffee brewing in the kitchens. Breakfast came, that inappropriate assortment of foods that BOAC advertise as an English country house breakfast, and the chief steward came round with the U.S. Customs forms, form number 6063 of the Treasury Department, and Bond read the small print. Failure to declare any article or any willfully false statement, fine or imprisonment or both, and wrote personal effects, and cheerfully signed the lie. And then there were 3 hours when the plane hung dead steady in the middle of the world, and only the patches of bright sunshine swaying slowly a few inches up and down the walls of the cabin gave a sense of motion. But at last there was the great sprawl of Boston below them, and then the bold pattern of a clover leaf on the New Jersey turnpike, and Bond's ears began to block with the slow descent towards the pall of haze that was the suburbs of New York. There was the hiss and sickly smell of the insecticide bomb, the shrill hydraulic whine of the air brakes and the landing wheels being lowered, the dip of the plane's nose, the tearing bump of the tires on the runway, the ugly roar as the screws were reversed to slow the plane for the entrance bay, the rumbling progress over the tired grass plain towards the tarmac apron, the clang of the hatch being opened. And they were there. End of side 3.